Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX 1460 AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I am the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound, and can be heard live streaming worldwide on WVOX.com. My guest today is Professor Noah Feldman, Chairman of the Department of Religion, of Law School at Harvard University, and he is the author of The Scorpions, about the Roosevelt Court, basically the battles of the four great Supreme Court justices, William O. Douglas, Felix Frankfurter, Robert Henry Jackson, and Hugo Black. Welcome, Professor Feldman, to The Advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Professor Feldman specializes in constitutional studies with a particular emphasis on the relationship between law and religion, constitutional design, the history of legal theory. As a Bemis Professor of Law at Harvard Law School, he's also a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Before joining Harvard faculty, he was the Cecilia Getz Professor of Law at NYU School of Law. He was named a Carnegie Scholar in 2005. In 2004, he was a visiting professor at Yale Law School and a fellow at the Whitney Humanities Center. In 2003, he served as a senior constitutional advisor for the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq, and subsequently advised members of the Iraqi Governing Council on the drafting of a transitional administrative law or interim constitution. He received his bachelor's degree summa cum laude at in Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations from Harvard University in 1992, was selected as a Rhodes Scholar. He earned his doctorate of philosophy in Islamic thought from Oxford University in 1994. He received a law degree from Yale Law School in 1997 and served as the book review's editor of the law, Yale Law Journal. After graduation, he served as a law clerk to Supreme Court Justice David Souter and to Chief Judge Harry T. Edwards of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. He's the author of five books, and of course the one we're going to discuss today, most recently published, is Scorpions, Battles and Triumphs of FDR's Great Supreme Court Justice. That's our subject today. Welcome again, Professor Feldman, to The Advocates.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. You know, Franklin D. Roosevelt was one of the most admired and hated presidents during his long tenure of office. Today, he's almost universally revered as the individual who rescued America from its financial freefall in the days following the end of President Herbert Hoover's only term in office. He's also fondly remembered and admired for his outstanding leadership during World War II. When FDR was sworn into office on March 4, 1933, the country faced its fourth year of depression. There was a revolutionary fervor in the air, and FDR promised action and action now. Professor Feldman, could you describe the mood that the country was in and how the president reacted?
There was a powerful, I would almost say a desperate concern in the country for what to be done about the circumstances of the Great Depression, because the breakdown was not just an enormous amount of unemployment or the significant collapse of the stock market, which had not turned back, but also social breakdown of families, of individuals that came alongside the economic breakdown. As crime began to rise in different parts of the country, as rates of suicide began to rise in different parts of the country, and people really had a sort of hopeless feeling, and there was a feeling that something very significant had to be done, and be done right away. And Roosevelt reacted to that with a very bold series of legislative announcements that were part of the so-called First New Deal.
You know, and as you frame it correctly, after 100 days in office, the New Deal president presented an incredible amount of reform legislation, approximately 15 bills to an anxious Congress, and almost all was passed, with many of the legislators not even reading all the details. During FDR's first term, he was one of the few presidents who did not have an opportunity to select a justice for consideration by the Senate. By the time of FDR's second term, most of the nine justices who had been sitting for a number of years, and they were called, I don't know whether nicely or accurately, the nine old men.
No one meant it positively.
Right. Yeah. The court reacted to multiple suits, declared much of the New Deal legal structure unconstitutional. Professor Feldman, who were these justices and what were their philosophical makeup?
The justices who rejected several of the crucial parts of the first New Deal, the National Industrial Recovery Act and the Agricultural Adjustment Act, were for the most part conservatives who had been appointed by conservative presidents in the previous 12 years. There were, though, a couple of exceptions to this, people who were conservatives but had been nevertheless nominated by Democrats. So, for example, Justice James McReynolds, who was one of the nastiest people ever to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court, had been Woodrow Wilson's attorney general and had been put on the court by Wilson. So there were, in fact, some conservatives who were Democratic appointees. On the other hand, I would also add that several of the more progressive justices, including Justice Cardozo of New York, actually voted to strike down at least some of the first New Deal legislation. So it wasn't exclusively conservative justices voting this way. But there was a core five-justice majority of conservatives who were appointees of, for the most part, conservative presidents, though, as I say, with some exceptions, who were consistently striking down this legislation. And Roosevelt was very frustrated. And as you know, and as your listeners know, he threatened to pack the Supreme Court. He threatened to have legislation passed that would add a new justice for every justice over 70 years of age. That would have been four new justices. And that would have given, of course, Roosevelt an opportunity to name four justices right away. And although ultimately he did not succeed in convincing Congress that this was the right course of action, the Supreme Court did flip. And one of the swing votes, Justice Owen Roberts, who was a sort of moderate conservative, flipped from the conservative side to the liberal side and began to vote to uphold federal legislation.
You know, it's interesting, as you mentioned, James McReynolds, who was appointed by Wilson. There's a story, and maybe you can corroborate this, that he was so anti-Semitic that he refused to pose in a picture with Justice Louis Brandeis, and they had to take two separate pictures of two different sections of the court. Is that an apocryphal story?
No, it was actually worse than that. Before the justices go onto the court to hear oral arguments, they always shake hands with each other. Everyone shakes everybody else's hand. It's a kind of ritual that you might imagine before a sports match. And McReynolds, in all of his years on the court with Justice Brandeis, would never even shake Brandeis' hand in private. And when Brandeis retired, McReynolds refused to sign the letter from the court congratulating him on his years of service. So we're talking about a person whose nastiness included anti-Semitism, though it was by no means restricted to that.
No, of course. You know, it's interesting, and of course, many people may not be aware that FDR, of course, was known for keeping his own counsel in one of the most controversial moments of his presidency, as you mentioned. Almost in virtual secrecy, he surprised the American public and the nation as a whole with his plan to enlarge the court. How was this reaction met initially?
The public reaction was, I think, mixed. On the one hand, the public really was frustrated with the Supreme Court, which was blocking legislation that people saw as necessary. And in the initial sort of review of the situation, it seemed that Roosevelt might actually be successful. And of course, you know, he had tremendous support in Congress for passing almost all the important legislation that he had introduced. But as people thought about it, they began to wonder if maybe having nine justices on the Supreme Court wasn't a good idea, and if perhaps adding more justices looked like a kind of proto-fascism in which the president was trying to seize power from one of the other branches of government. And what really, I think, turned the tide against Roosevelt was that several members of the Supreme Court, including the Chief Justice, Charles Evans Hughes, and two of the other senior justices, including Justice Louis Brandeis, who was on the progressive side of the court, signed a letter saying that there was no need to pack the court, that the court was up on its business, that it was doing a good job, and that things shouldn't change. And that, I think, caused public opinion and also congressional opinion to turn against Roosevelt. And Roosevelt was extremely frustrated by this, and although he had had a very warm relationship with Brandeis before this, this led to a real split between the two men, and they never spoke to each other again right up to the time of Brandeis' death.
You know, and so people understand there, the number of Supreme Court justices has varied over the years, and it wasn't sacrosanct at nine. It was never in the Constitution that there be nine justices. And in just to review this, as you just mentioned, on July 22, 1937, the United States Senate rejected FDR's court reorganization plan. But FDR would eventually replace all the so-called nine old men, as the court was known. He obviously replaced the four staunch conservatives. Some had resigned after there was a switch in nine, as I said, to save
switch
time.
Switch in time that saved
right.
Nine, exactly.
Butler, McReynolds, Van Deventer, and Sutherland, who were the core of the justices that ruled almost all of the New Deal legislation and regulations unconstitutional.
Right, you know, they were called the Four Horsemen.
Right, as a reflection of the Four Horsemen and the Apocalypse, no
exactly.
Doubt about it. You know, this, of course, course, opened the door for FDR to make his first appointments. You've written a book about the machinations regarding the appointments and the careers of these four critically respected justices. With that in mind, who were these men, and why is this story so relevant for today's generation?
The first to be appointed was Hugo Lafayette Black, who was a senator and was appointed by FDR because he wanted somebody who would be radical and political to send a message to the world that he considered the Supreme Court a political entity, but also whom the Senate would have no choice but to confirm. And that was why it was very clever to choose Black, because since Black was a senator, the other senators would feel an obligation to confirm him. And in fact, that's what happened. He was nominated on a Wednesday and confirmed the following Saturday with no hearing of the modern type. And it was only after two or three weeks of intense research and bribery by the national newspapers that it was proven definitively that he had been a member of the Ku Klux Klan in Alabama in the run-up to his running for the United States Senate. As you can imagine, that caused an enormous scandal at the national level when it was discovered that a man who had been named to the Supreme Court and confirmed, and therefore had life tenure, had previously been a member of the Ku Klux Klan. Extraordinary reaction from the general public, and Black had to go onto the radio and explain himself, and he said that he had been a member of the Klan. He did not apologize for it, but he was no longer a member of the Klan, and that he said that some of his best friends were Jews and Catholics, and some of his friends were Black, which is a particularly outrageous statement, although Roosevelt could live with it. And when Roosevelt met with him after this, he put his arm around him and he said, "Don't worry, Hugo, some of my best friends are Klan members." Showed you that Roosevelt had a sense of humor about the whole thing, maybe appropriately, maybe not. The next appointment that of the justices about whom I write that he got was the great Felix Frankfurter. Felix Frankfurter was probably the best-known liberal law professor in the United States at the time, kind of a superstar law professor who had defended Sacco and Vanzetti and been on the national board of the ACLU and of the NAACP, very well-known and thought of as a leading liberal. He was also someone who had participated in the drafting of important New Deal legislation, including the Securities and Exchange Act of 1932. And this was considered a big victory for liberals to get Frankfurter onto the Supreme Court. But later in his career, Frankfurter turned into a judicial conservative when his judicial philosophy of judicial restraint was one that he insisted on maintaining, despite the fact that liberals had a majority on the court and could become activists. He refused to become an activist, so he came to be seen as a conservative. Next was William O. Douglas. Douglas was the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. He was a very young man. He was only 38 when he became chairman of the SEC. He was a protege of Joe Kennedy Sr., who had introduced him to Roosevelt. They played in the same poker game. Roosevelt's inner circle played in a poker game that was a very significant place for important decision-making to get done. And Roosevelt said, "That young man plays an interesting game of poker." And when Justice Brandeis retired, that opened a slot on the court, and the appointment went to Douglas, who was just 40 years old when he was appointed to the Supreme Court. Douglas was tremendously politically ambitious, and Roosevelt wanted him to be his vice president. And in 1944, when Roosevelt was making what was to be the most important vice presidential appointment ever, because he was going to his fourth term, he wasn't well, he wanted Douglas, not Truman, but the party bosses wanted Truman. And they felt correctly that they could never have controlled Douglas. And the bosses were so powerful that they actually got Douglas excluded, and they were able to get Truman named as the vice presidential nominee.
And Truman even went to the convention under the thinking that he would be nominating James F. Burns for vice president.
Or so he claimed. So he claimed.
That's true.
In fact, Jimmy Burns was from South Carolina, a state which he later went back to as governor. And whether he actually would have been a viable national candidate at that time is a little bit uncertain to me.
Well, of course, he was considered anti-labor, and he had converted from Catholicism to being a Protestant.
Exactly, he converted from Catholicism to Protestantism, which was not optimal from the standpoint of being a vice president. But in any case, Truman played it very skillfully, went to the convention, met with labor, which was not his natural constituency, a constituency that would have preferred Douglas, charmed them, got his ducks in a row, and then was able to get the nomination, and Douglas did not have the political clout to compete.
And our last one of the
our last great justice of Roosevelt's period is Robert Jackson from upstate New York. He was born in the town of Frewsburg and then made his career in Jamestown, New York, where he was a lawyer who began his career trying cases involving horses and cows, really, really small-scale stuff, but then became a rather substantial corporate lawyer as Jamestown became increasingly industrialized. And he knew Roosevelt from the time he was a very young man, because he was that rarest of breeds at the time, an upstate Democrat, still not the most common breed in the whole wide world. And Roosevelt was running for office, statewide office, and so he got to know Democrats all over the state, and so that's how Jackson knew him. Jackson subsequently went to Washington in the Roosevelt administration, not right away, but after a couple of years, as general counsel of the predecessor to the IRS, the Bureau of Inland Revenue, and or Internal Revenue, rather. And in this position, he became nationally famous for the tax prosecution, the tax fraud prosecution of Andrew Mellon. Mellon was the third richest man in America and had been Secretary of the Treasury for almost a dozen years. Right. So he was sort of Warren Buffett and Robert Rubin rolled into one. It's an enormously significant and influential person. And the Roosevelt administration had very unwisely decided to prosecute him for tax fraud. It hadn't gone well. And Jackson salvaged things, eventually convincing Mellon to donate to the public his art collection, which was the best art collection in the world, to become the basis for the National Gallery in Washington, D.C. And while he was at it, Mellon threw in the building. That's how rich he was.
He was really finessed.
he really was. And then subsequently, Jackson played an important advisory role to Roosevelt. He became Solicitor General, arguing the cases of the government in front of the Supreme Court, where he had an amazing record, winning 28 out of 31 cases. He then became Attorney General of the United States, where he advised Roosevelt in the run-up to the Second World War on how the United States could aid Great Britain while maintaining its neutrality as a legal matter. And then he went on to the Supreme Court, where he became a very important justice, not necessarily recognized as such in his lifetime, but today so influential that several of the most recent nominees, Justice Alito and Justice Roberts, both said in their confirmation hearings their model justice was Robert Jackson.
Mm. You know, I want to remind our audience that they're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM and live streaming worldwide on WVOX.com with myself, Richard Garfunkel, and my guest, Professor Noah Feldman of the Harvard Law School. And we're talking about his book, Scorpions and the Four Great Justices that FDR appointed in the wake of the Court Reorganization Plan of 1937, or what is familiarly known as the Court Packing Fight. You know, your book, Professor Feldman, has an unusual title, Scorpions. What is the meaning of the title and why did you use it?
An observer of this group of justices said that the Supreme Court was like nine scorpions in a bottle, by which he meant that these were incredibly ambitious, powerful, intellectually confident people who were locked in a little bottle together, that bottle being the Supreme Court, with life tenure. And although they began as friends and allies of Roosevelt and of each other, they ended up differing with each other extremely strongly. And that had two sides. It had an intellectual side, where they developed four different ways of seeing the Constitution. And it also had a personal side, where these friends became personal enemies and really grew to actually hate each other. And one of the suggestions that I make in the book is that a collegiality might be an overrated virtue when it comes to Supreme Court justices, that some of the greatest justices ever, and these four men were all among the greatest justices ever, who came up with the most influential constitutional ideas, actually did not get along well with each other, did not play well with others, and were actually quite brutal to each other at times. But this form of competition, had the positive effect of driving them to come up with and refine their greatest ideas.
Mm. You know, you describe the process, and we'll get back to Hugo Black with this. You describe the process of vetting presidential nominees for the high court by the president and the Senate in the days before World War II in an interesting way. How did it evolve, and did the nomination of Hugo Black change the process forever?
You know, it probably should have, but it didn't. You know, there didn't used to often be any kind of even a hearing for most nominees. The first person ever to have any kind of a hearing was Louis Brandeis, and that was because, really primarily, because of anti-Semitism. The next person to have a hearing was Felix Frankfurter, so not a coincidence at all. Frankfurter also broke precedent because he was the first person ever to appear at his hearings. Prior to that, if there was a hearing, you would send a representative to speak on your behalf. Frankfurter originally sent Dean Acheson, who later became Secretary of State, but was out of government at the time, but was his close friend, to appear on his behalf at the Senate hearing. But then he realized that the anti-Semitic and anti-leftist rhetoric of some of the senators was so great that he had to go and appear on his own behalf and defend his reputation and say that he was a proud American and just as American as the senators, and they asked him, you know, sir, are you now or have you ever been a communist? And he said, you know, I would hold up my commitment to my Americanism against yours any day, Senator. And the entire gallery burst into applause. It was a great success for Frankfurter. The black nomination, you'd think, would have led to a much more detailed vetting process. I mean, this is a person who was nominated and confirmed extremely quickly with nobody bothering to figure out that he had been a Ku Klux Klan member, which is tremendously embarrassing to the Roosevelt administration. And yet it didn't lead to any very profound subsequent vetting, because if it had, it would almost certainly have made it difficult for some of the other nominees of Roosevelt's to make it onto the court. I think one recognition that people had in that period and that Roosevelt had is that the Supreme Court was a political body. And for that reason, political nominees were welcomed. Mm. So, you know, when William O. Douglas was nominated to the court, as chairman of the SEC, he had threatened to take over the New York Stock Exchange. He had gone around the country giving speeches that were incredibly critical of capital, of business in the United States. And yet he sailed right through on the confirmation process. So I think there was a different conception at the time of what made somebody confirmable than we have today. And I think we've actually lost by that. I think we now have so much caution in the nomination process that people have this idea that if anyone's expressed any opinions about anything, that it'll be difficult to get them confirmed. And so what we get is a much more cautious, careful, and narrowly focused kind of nominee.
And also, to a degree, I don't think people expected people to live that long, stay on the court that long. Certain people resigned, administrations changed, people probably thought having people who were politically aware as a better mix. And it may have been that they weren't, certainly up until the New Deal, the amount of controversy that the court dealt with was sort of minor in comparison to, let's call it without embellishment, nitpicking today.
I think that's right. And I think that the period of the early New Deal, when the court was striking down these major pieces of legislation, was the most political moment in the whole history of the Supreme Court, with the possible exception of Brown against the Board of Education, which is the climax of the book that I've written, of Scorpions, at which the Supreme Court struck down segregation, a very heroic act, but also one that angered at least white people in much of the American South.
Right. You know, getting back to the confirmation process, Louis Brandeis and Benjamin Cardozo were the first two Jewish justices nominated and appointed to the Supreme Court, and historically they've been considered two of the finest judges who have served on the high bench. After Brandeis's resignation and Cardozo's death, what was the opposition to the elevation of Felix Frankfurter to the court, and why? Especially from FDR, to a degree.
Remarkably, some of the people who were most strongly advocating against Frankfurter were American Jews, who were concerned that putting another Jewish justice on the court at a time when Brandeis was still on the court, though he was going to resign any time, was actually going to encourage anti-Semitism. Mm. So you can see the kind of extreme caution that the American Jewish community felt at the time. And actually a delegation of very, very well-known and prominent American Jews actually went to Roosevelt to argue against Frankfurter. Some of them also may have felt that Frankfurter was too much of a liberal, was too well-known a liberal, and that was, I think, another concern that people had about him. You know, he was someone who had been identified with some Jewish causes. He had worked with Brandeis on behalf of American Zionism. But unlike Brandeis, I don't think he was a deeply committed Zionist. It was something that he did in part because Brandeis encouraged him to do it, and he thought of himself very much as an American first, last, and always, and he would sometimes say that he had substituted Americanism for Judaism as his personal faith.
And of course, it isn't in your book, but you covered slightly, is that there was a relationship between Frankfurter and Brandeis. There was a financial and emotional relationship where Brandeis assisted Frankfurter. And of course, again, you mention in your book very interestingly and cogently that the Roosevelt had almost an intimate relationship with justices, which today seems, you know, verboten.
It's amazing. I mean, with the exception of Black, whom he knew, as it were, only professionally as a potential ally and sometimes rival in the Senate, Roosevelt knew the other nominees extremely well. He didn't have to interview these people. Both Jackson and Douglas were members of his poker-playing circle, and he'd known them both for a good amount of time before he put them on the court. And Frankfurter he knew extremely well and corresponded with regularly. So these were people he really knew extremely well. They were not people with judicial experience, unlike today's judges who typically have some judicial experience. And they were very political and very, very self-consciously known as political.
You know, I want to remind our audience that they're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM and live streaming worldwide on WVOX.com. My guest is Professor Noah Feldman of the Harvard Law School. We're talking about his book, Scorpions and FDR's Four Great Justices, Felix Frankfurter, Hugo Black, William O. Douglas, and Robert Henry Jackson. You know, Felix Frankfurter, who was born in Vienna and was a man of great intellect, unique friendships and connections, was thought of as one of the great American liberals. When the court voted 8-1 rejecting the Jehovah's Witness refusal to salute the flag, what happened to Frankfurter, and who wrote the majority opinion, and what was the reaction, and did it change him?
Well, the first time that the court considered this issue, and this was in the period where Germany was overtaking France and Paris was soon to fall, in the summer of 1940. The question was whether Jehovah's Witnesses who refused to salute the flag because they believed it violated their religious principles should be entitled to an exemption from the rule that required flag salutes. And 8-1, with Justice Frankfurter writing the opinion, the Supreme Court said no, that the witnesses were not entitled to that exemption, that the general rule requiring saluting the flag did in fact apply to them. And Frankfurter's reasoning was that although he said he personally would be happy if the state would allow the witnesses not to salute the flag, that the state had within its rights the capacity to choose how to inculcate values of loyalty, especially in the run-up to wartime. And he believed that the Constitution did not entitle people to an exemption from a neutral and generally applicable rule such as this one. And the only justice who dissented was Harlan Fiske Stone, a Republican appointee, who said that this was an issue of civil liberties. And a couple of years later, so then in the immediate aftermath of that decision, there were really terrible consequences for Jehovah's Witnesses around the country. Many people in the public took this Supreme Court opinion as kind of a justification for further anger towards and violence against Jehovah's Witnesses. And lots of cities and towns adopted laws saying they would expel Jehovah's Witnesses' children from school if they didn't salute the flag. There were attacks on Kingdom Halls, which was the name of the meeting house of the Jehovah's Witnesses. Some witnesses were physically attacked and harmed. So it was really a terrible moment in American history, a really unfortunate moment of outpouring of discriminatory violence. And the other liberals on the Supreme Court were horrified by this, horrified that it was happening, horrified that the liberal press strongly rejected the Supreme Court's judgment. And they more or less announced in an opinion that they were ready to hear this case again, to hear the issue represented to them. So a couple of years later, the issue was represented to them. And this time the court voted the other way, leaving Frankfurter in dissent. Mm-hmm. And Justice Robert Jackson, who had not been on the court when the first case was decided, wrote a classic and important opinion in which he said, among other things, that in the West Virginia against Barnett case, that if there is any fixed star in our constitutional firmament, it is that the state shall not dictate what is orthodox in matters of politics or religion. I'm paraphrasing. So Justice Jackson was announcing that the witnesses were entitled to an exemption, and he said there were some things that the job of the courts was to take away from the political parts of the government, and this was one of them. Mm. And Justice Frankfurter was deeply wounded by this reversal of fortune. He believed that both at a personal level, as a Jew, and he was criticized as a Jew for having written the opinion that he wrote, and also at a professional level as a leader of the court's liberals, he was being rejected, his views were being rejected. And he wrote a heartfelt dissent that began with a very personal passage that said, as a member of the most persecuted and vilified minority in history, I naturally would like to see the localities allowing the witnesses this freedom. But he said, as judges, we are neither Jew nor Gentile, Protestant nor Catholic. And his idea was that he could not allow his particular identity as a member of a minority to influence his judgment. He didn't want to empathize and to use that empathy to decide the case. He wanted to decide the case on the basis of the Constitution. And it was really a tragic moment for Frankfurter because he was standing up for very important principles, the principles of objectivity, the principles of constitutional judgment, the principles of judicial restraint. But in the eyes of most of the rest of the court and the rest of the country, he had just missed the boat, and he was voting to uphold laws that were perceived by them as oppressive.
Mm. You know, FDR's choice of Jackson, and you're talking about Robert Henry Jackson, of course, in along with Felix Frankfurter, was his seventh of nine justices he appointed. Most could easily assume that that record of appointees will never be broken. Before we get into the Scorpion's differences, did FDR fail with his choices of Frank Murphy and James Burns?
Well, James Burns didn't serve for long enough to us really know whether he would have amounted to anything as a justice. He didn't amount to anything in the short time that he served. But when Roosevelt, when the United States entered the war, needed someone to be the coordinator of mobilization, what they called the assistant president at the time, Frankfurter recommended Jimmy Burns, who was a very politically skilled person. And Roosevelt picked Burns, and Burns did, as far as I'm aware, actually, a pretty creditable job in that very, very difficult role, and then went back into state politics, becoming eventually the governor of South Carolina. So Burns is hard to know. Murphy, though, is a very complicated case. Murphy was a liberal. He might even be called a knee-jerk liberal. Frankfurter made bitter fun of him. They called him a Saint Francis. He would call him God, because he said that Murphy thought that he was God. And most of the other justices at the time didn't take Murphy seriously. They didn't think he was a very skilled justice. They didn't think he was a very sophisticated justice. And yet Murphy really distinguished himself in the case of the internment of the Japanese Americans during the war, at which moment the other justices, for the most part, the Roosevelt appointees, were prepared to allow that internment to go forward. Robert Jackson offered a partial dissent where he said, well, I don't think we should say it's constitutional, but it should still be allowed to happen, which really wasn't that much of a dissent. But Murphy said point blank, this is racism, and it's unconstitutional, and you shouldn't be able to do it. So I think, you know, Murphy redeemed what would otherwise be a fairly meager historical reputation by that great judgment, standing up for a moral principle. So I think, you know, there's a mixed verdict on Frank Murphy, historically speaking.
You know, President Roosevelt had intended to reshape the court into a unified, progressive force for years to come. Black, Frankfurter, Douglas, and Jackson appointments, Jackson was appointed in July of 1941, seemed to fit this vision quite well. What happened to FDR's expectations regarding their common purpose, and how did these four become such enemies?
FDR's purposes basically were not met. To the extent that FDR expected they would vote to allow federal legislation without blocking it, he was right about that. He got that narrow objective. But what happened was that the values of liberalism changed as it had to confront new problems. During the period of the New Deal, the great concern for liberalism was primarily the question of whether economic reform should be undertaken. But during the war and then during the Cold War, new issues of civil liberties and civil rights, of personal freedom and equality, became the central debates for liberalism. And his justices splintered on this question. This is also how they fell apart individually. Justice Frankfurter, as we just mentioned, was not willing for the Supreme Court to be a strong defender of civil liberties, and that led him to become a judicial conservative. Justice Jackson went to Nuremberg, where he served as chief prosecutor for the war crimes tribunals for a year. He just took a year off from the Supreme Court, another amazing thing. He didn't ask anybody's permission. He just got up and went. And he, when he came back from Nuremberg, was very skeptical of civil liberties claims, especially by communists, because he believed that he had learned while there how the Weimar Republic had failed and how liberal democracy in Germany had given way to Nazism by virtue of the state not being harsh enough in restricting the challenge of the Nazis and of the communists. And so he saw communism as something that should not be tolerated in the United States, and it led him to a very conservative position on the civil liberties, especially of communists, again, leading him to split from the other justices. For their parts, Justice Black and Justice Douglas went in a different direction. Justice Black invented a new constitutional philosophy, the philosophy of originalism, according to which the Constitution should be interpreted to mean just what the Founding Fathers had said it should mean and nothing more. For him, that was actually a liberal philosophy. Today, it's a conservative philosophy right in the hands of Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, but then it was a liberal philosophy, and it actually led him to his own redemptive moment. When Brown against the Board of Education was being discussed, the great desegregation case, in the privacy of the conference room, there were four justices at the time who had experiences with segregation. And the other three all said, we can never strike down segregation. It's too pervasive. It's too deep. It'll lead to too much resistance in the South. And Black alone said, of course there will be resistance, and I don't care. The true meaning of the 14th Amendment is that Any system of caste based on race is unconstitutional. Segregation is certainly that. We must vote to strike it down. And in that moment, which is the greatest moment ever for the philosophy of originalism, but also in Black's professional life, I think he redeemed his shameful past as having been a Klan member. But his constitutional philosophy was the opposite of that of Frankfurter and Jackson. Jackson was a pragmatist, and Frankfurter believed in restraint. Black, by contrast, believed in originalism, which was quite a different way of doing things, and it also drove him apart from the others. And last but not least, Douglas. For his first decade on the court, most of the justices didn't have much respect for him, and especially Frankfurter and Jackson, because they thought he wanted to be president, and he was just being a politician on the court. But over time, he found a constitutional vision, and that was the vision that, according to which the point of a constitution was to maximize individual liberty, to make people as personally free as they could be. And that led him to support the right to contraception and then eventually the right to abortion. And it's the same constitutional idea that underlies also the right to same-sex sex, and which may be held by the Supreme Court to underlie a right to same-sex marriage if the Supreme Court indeed so holds. And the other justices couldn't go with Douglas on this. They didn't have the same conception of individual freedom as the greatest value. And they also came to dislike Black, Douglas rather at a personal level, because he was increasingly nasty as he got older, and his personal life was also extremely erratic. He was divorced 3 times, married four times. Each time he married someone younger. The last one was 22 when he was 69. The other justices just frankly didn't approve of the way he was living. And yet he became a great justice by virtue of this philosophy of individual liberty.
You know, it's interesting. A quick question for you. During that one-year hiatus where Justice Jackson served in the Nuremberg trials as the chief prosecutor, were there any close decisions, or were there were no 4-4 decisions? And it really
there were.
Didn't...
There actually were some 4-4 decisions. And in some cases, the then Chief Justice, Harlan Fiske Stone, held them over so they could be re-argued the next year. And in some cases, they did what the Supreme Court does when it reaches a 4-4 decision, which is that it automatically affirms whatever the lower court did. They call that affirmed by a divided court without creating any precedent. And that happened on some occasions as well. So it was actually extremely inconvenient for the court. And Stone was furious that Jackson had gone off and done this. And a very interesting thing that I found out when I was working on the book was that in his private correspondence, Stone was not only personally angry at Jackson for doing this, but he's also very dismissive of the Nuremberg trials, which he referred to as a lynching. He considered it not to be the rule of law at all. He said, "I don't mind what you do to Nazis, but I very much resent it being dressed up as though it were a trial, when in fact, he predicted the verdict was already known in advance." Of course, that wasn't true. Several of the defendants were actually acquitted at Nuremberg. But Stone's other great objection was that at Nuremberg, the Germans were not being charged with genocide. For the most part, they were being charged with the crime of aggressive war.
Right.
And yet that crime was not well established as a matter of law prior to the war.
Yeah. You know, on December 7th, speaking of the war, 1941, almost 69 years ago, now priorities radically changed in America, affecting all of our institutions. All in all, FDR focused on the war and put on his proverbial win the war hat, taking off his Dr. New Deal hat. Who in the following years until his death and after had the most influence of these judges?
They had different influence, I think, really in different ways. During the war years, Frankfurter had the most influence, both among the other justices, whom he often convinced to back Roosevelt, as in the saboteurs case, the case where the Supreme Court had to decide whether some Nazi saboteurs could be executed, as Roosevelt wanted to do, and they were, in fact, executed. But then over time, after Roosevelt's death, Frankfurter's influence on his colleagues substantially declined, and he had no influence whatsoever on Truman. In fact, he had no relationship with Truman. In fact, none of these justices had any meaningful relationship with Truman at all. So all of their political influence declined radically after Roosevelt's death. Jackson is probably the most influential of these justices now in terms of the Supreme Court's opinions. His famous opinion in the Steele seizure case, in which he laid out a framework for how power of the president should be weighed against the power of Congress, is one of the most important opinions ever in the history of the Supreme Court. And yet, it was not seen as an important opinion in his lifetime. No other justices joined that opinion. He signed it alone. And he died in 1954 thinking that he had been a failure, thinking that he had not really achieved constitutional greatness. So his influence has been huge, but it came later. Justice Black also had a big influence through his philosophy of originalism, but that was not mostly in his lifetime when no other justice accepted that philosophy. It was only after his death this came to be seen as a dominant philosophy. And Justice Douglas knew he had an influence in the Warren Court, where many of his liberal ideals were realized. The problem was he never got the credit for it. Yeah. Even though he was the one doing the heavy intellectual lifting, he was a terrible poster child for the values of individual liberty, because his life made it look as though he favored individual liberty so that he could, you know, get divorced and remarried,
right,
and chase after women. And so,
and he had
went to William Brennan, to Thurgood Marshall, who were, you know, Marshall was a legitimate hero of the civil rights movement, and Brennan was a great justice who was very personally conservative, even though he was politically liberal.
Yeah, it's interesting. And of course, Douglas had problems with his publishing, and he was
financial difficulties.
Congress
to impeach him.
Right.
I mean, really,
Congressman Ford brought him up and wanted to have him impeached over an article in Evergreen magazine, as I recall quite well at the time, listening to it. You know, Brown versus the Board of Education, Topeka, and the death of Justice Jackson came about close to the same time. Was this the beginning of the end of the Roosevelt Court?
It was. And in fact, even in the most literal level, the last great act of the Roosevelt Court, the last act of a court that had five justices appointed by Roosevelt, was Brown against the Board of Education, the great desegregation decision. And after the case was announced in 1954, and it took Jackson coming out of his hospital bed where he had been hospitalized after a heart attack to come into the Supreme Court to make sure all the justices were present. That fall, when the court reconvened, Jackson was just there for the first day, and then he had a heart attack and he died. And at that point, the Roosevelt Court was really finished. We were down to only four justices who had been appointed by Roosevelt. So I think that really was the last great act of the Roosevelt Court, and it was something that Roosevelt himself almost certainly would have approved. It wasn't only the morally right thing to do, and it was the right morally right thing to do, but it was also very helpful to the United States in its foreign policy. Because during the Cold War, the U.S. was being heavily criticized for the fact of segregation, for being an apartheid nation. And there was no way for the U.S. Senate to change this because of the filibuster rule, and the southern states themselves were blocking African Americans from voting, so democratic means were not going to change segregation. And there was no real option for anyone to act other than the Supreme Court. And so the Supreme Court actually was helping America's foreign policy, not only our domestic justice, when it reached that great decision.
I want to remind our audience that they are listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 and live streaming on WVOX.com with my guest, Professor Noah Feldman, the Harvard Law School. We're talking about his book, Scorpions and FDR's Four Great Justices, Frankfurter, Black, Douglas, and Jackson. In our closing moments, Professor Feldman, one lesson apparent to all students of that era is that FDR's style would be much more difficult to replicate in today's 24/7 news cycle. Could FDR's social and political intimacy with sitting justices be replicated today?
It could be, but the social norms have changed to the point where it would be frowned upon. Not only was there an annual dinner with the justices going over to the president's house, a practice that continued even somewhat after Roosevelt but is now gone, but the kind of personal, casual contact over, for example, his poker game, or the private correspondence between Frankfurter and Roosevelt, you know, dear Frank, dear Felix, that continued in the years he was on the court, would just be seen today as violating the separation between the different branches of government. And that was just not seen that way at the time. You know, there was a war on, and the war required special circumstances, but it's also true that those kinds of personal relationships are just less accepted today across the branches of government than they were at the time. And I think that's a shame, because the Supreme Court does inevitably have to make political judgments. And to do that, it's good if it has an understanding of how the way Washington and the whole world actually works. So if you think of the Supreme Court saying that Paula Jones's lawsuit could go forth against Bill Clinton while he was in office, because what possible difficulty could there be for the president to run the country if he was being sued in a civil lawsuit? It's a good example of just a real incomprehension on the part of the justices of the political realities of how Washington really works. You can never have had a mistake like that, a mistake that led to, you know, the opening of the Monica Lewinsky investigation and the eventual impeachment of Bill Clinton and really the total distraction of the entire United States government for a period of almost 3 years. That could not have happened in a period where the justices were more intimate with the way presidential politics actually works.
You know, and in a follow-up to that, what is the historical lesson we can learn about FDR's reactions regarding the court and its political manipulation? Was he always the lion and the fox?
No. I mean, there were moments when even the great Franklin Roosevelt's ability to make the right judgment would sometimes fall down. And I think in the court packing plan is a good example. He was so devoted to the idea that he had to win and be seen to have won that even when he had already had a de facto victory of getting the switch in time, of getting the court to uphold his legislation, he couldn't stop. He kept on pushing for and demanding Congress to fold and allow him to pack the court. And that was, I think, a substantial misjudgment politically by a man who made very few such misjudgments.
Do you think but the death of Louis Howe not too much before hurt him in terms of not having that intimate advisor to say to him, be careful where you tread?
Yeah, he didn't have someone who could say to him in that moment, no, Mr. President, no, this is a terrible idea. And Howe had played that role for him as his political advisor, and I think that may have had something to do with it. I also think that, you know, he was at a moment in his career where he had successfully reformed many aspects of American public life, and where other leaders in other countries were coming to dominate, their executive branches were coming to dominate the other branches of government. And I think he was tempted by the idea of more power. I mean, I think, you know, he was human, and the impulse to power was real. On the other hand, we're lucky as a country that he didn't get that court packing plan, because it would, I think, in the long run, have deeply undercut the legitimacy of the Supreme Court as an institution.
You know, it's interesting, of course, with the death of Joe Robinson of Arkansas, who led the fight on the floor, it seemed that the effort was lost. It's possible if Robinson, who was promised by FDR, had said that for the next opening on the Supreme Court would have been chosen. If he would have lived, it's possible they would have had a partial victory on this. But I think, as you said, maybe it was better that it did not happen. And also, quickly, before we come to a close, how do people, from your research, how do people, the general public, look at the court vis-a-vis the 1930s and today? Is it a similar level of respect, or how do you see that?
I actually think the court is more respected today than it was then. I think at that time, the court was seen as almost purely political, and its positive role was not as clear. I think today people understand the court is political. You know, anyone who's alive during the Bush against Gore litigation knows that the Supreme Court has a political aspect. But I think the Supreme Court has also done some things in those years, and Brown against Board of Education, the desegregation decision, is the most famous of them, that have also given the court the legitimacy of an institution that can really do justice under the right circumstances. And I think people today have a kind of split vision of the court. On the one hand, people understand that it's political. On the other hand, they also believe, I think correctly, that the justices, by their oath lights, are doing the best job they can to interpret the Constitution and are trying to do justice when possible, and are trying to get the right results for our country. They may differ about what those results are, but they are trying. And I think that for that reason, again, although people criticize the court for its political division, which are real, nevertheless, the institution has a kind of prestige in the country that is actually quite remarkable.
I want to thank you. This has been a fascinating hour. I want to thank Professor Noah Feldman of Harvard University for joining Advocates today. And before we end, thank you and good luck and have a happy holiday season. Professor Feldman, thanks for calling in.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived Advocates broadcasts, you can access them on my website, advocates-wvox.com, where the information my guests will be posted. Next week, I'll have Cheryl Paradise, and we'll be discussing The Criminal Mind, The Death Penalty, and her book, Measure of Madness. Thank you again, Professor Feldman.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.